Hello and welcome to edition 353 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck, and Robert Bound.
On the show today, we'll be asking, where do you go after you've been to the furthest place imaginable, the moon? Filmmaker Mark Craig will be telling us this and about his new documentary, The Last Man on the Moon, a little later.
We'll also be getting a class act in koala diplomacy from an expert in the field, the Australian High Commissioner to the UK, Alexander Downer.
And we'll be talking to Edwina Ehrman, curator of a new exhibition all about a less storied section of the wardrobe, underwear, at the V&A right here in London.
That's all to come, plus Monocle's Henry Rhys Sheridan will be predicting next week's news, and we'll enjoy some good music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
So there we have it, Andrew. Before we bring out the gathering storm, really, in the Monocle Weekly arsenal, which is Henry Rhys Sheridan and his normally quite political but always fun news look ahead. Yeah. This is the part of the show where we talk about our weeks. How has yours been? Has it been scattered with beautiful flowers?
It's been more about precision engineering. We're getting down to the final details of the Monocle conference,
yep,
which is in Vienna. It starts this coming weekend. Well, we get there on Friday. We have a nice shindig on the Friday and then a bit of a debate on all day Saturday.
Yeah.
So I think there may be like one or two tickets left, but come along and join us in Vienna. It's going to be an amazing, amazing weekend. All of the senior editors are there. We've got 25 great speakers from around the world. So let the fun begin, as they say, Mr. Band. And you're going to be there. You're even doing a bit of a kind of guided tour on the Sunday.
We're doing all sorts of things. One of the things we managed to stick on to our already rather packed and fun itinerary is a tour of the Kunsthistorisch Museum, a fantastic old school European museum, with none other than Jasper Sharp, who people won't need to Google him. They'll know him. He's going to be there. But not square. It's going to be good stuff. You and I, we're going to be hosting a couple of the talks on stage. Maybe we'll high five as we walk on and off.
A high five is good.
I think
good.
We're doing one ourselves.
Have we worked out how to get the gin into the water glasses yet?
I think we've been practicing. We've got some new carafes in the office, haven't we? More small scale, kind of classier carafes. I think there's been a little bit of gin action.
And I just wanted to check, as we prepare for the little discussion with Edwina about the underwear exhibition.
Yeah.
Have you worn some for once?
Yeah, what we don't normally tell our listeners is that this is informally known as Commando Sunday. Andrew and I tend to come in. We're always sporting a trouser or a short in the summer, rarely an underpant. But I think today, just so that she can judge, she can judge what we're wearing, we have decided to underdress.
Okay. Commander Bound and me are ready and waiting for none other than Henry Rhys Sheridan. Henry, oh Henry. Henry, before we get started, what kind of man? Boxer, why thong?
Boxer, always.
Always a boxer?
Always boxer.
Boxer short or
I like a generous gusset. What can I say?
Okay.
You find it rides up with a jean and you're kind of like endlessly trying to get the things down, as it were?
As you might have noticed, I also favour a loose trouser on most days, so I don't tend to suffer from that problem. Although in the past I have, when I had a thinner leg.
Okay, so you're not trying to always get the rind out of your teeth.
Some bunching.
Not as much as when I was a younger man, Rob.
And pattern or plain?
I actually have a fairly well-balanced underwear drawer in terms of patterns. I've got some block colours. I've got some gingham.
Okay.
And I've got some curveballs. Which I'll say.
Well, they're always hard to get into a short, aren't they?
Always.
No wonder you favour a baggy gusset.
Sure, I mean, it's... Yeah.
Okay.
Pardon me, I'm getting all worked up here. Yeah. Not even launched into the news yet.
You need a glass
I'm
of
actually
water.
Pouring myself a glass of water.
Yeah, do you have one. Feel free. Help yourself.
Rich for me.
Help yourself. I guess, but help yourself.
Thanks. Shall we?
Yeah, I think it might be safer.
Let's go straight to some hard news.
Andrew wasn't here last week. I knew you here, Rob. It was a little bit of a down news review, wasn't it?
It was quite serious. It's quite political.
Well, I heard you describe it as quite political. Now, obviously, today I do have to launch the political story because it's a very important one. On the 13th of April,
yeah,
there's a general election taking place in Syria.
Right.
So
that is, yes. I thought I had an awful moment there. I thought we were going to have to seg from pants
no,
to Syria.
No. Yeah. Well, we have. Yeah, we have had to do that.
We
to
have
do
done
so.
Said thing.
Obviously, Assad called the poll on the 22nd of February following Syrian Arab army gains and, of course, very heavy Russian intervention in the state. To what extent is the election going to solidify any political stability there? Probably little, but we'll have to watch the space to find out. I'm not an expert in the region. I do not want to make any serious predictions.
Well, that makes two of us at least.
But I'm opening up the floor. Yeah. I'm opening up the floor to you two if you want to say anything.
I'm happy
about
to allow the people of Syria to make their own minds up. I wouldn't want to come down on either side.
Okay.
I'm still thinking about your curveballs.
I've been bent.
I want this new Duckerhead to be as balanced as your underpant drawer. Neither dressing to the left nor right.
Let's see if we can bring it into line with that ideal right now.
Okay, let's look it straight in the eyes.
On the 16th of April, this guy's a recurring character in my news reviews. You know I like his soft power.
Yeah.
It's Pope Francis, and what's he doing now? He's visiting the Greek island of Lesbos with the Orthodox Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew.
Wow.
In a symbolic and humanitarian visit.
That's like one of those great... It's like sort of seeing the Sex Pistols at the Manchester Free Trade Hall in 1977. Everyone says they're going to be there, but who is going to be there?
Exactly.
Yeah, everyone will be boasting about that, won't they?
Francis will be there.
Yeah.
Now, you remember I covered it back in February. It was the first meeting of the Catholic and Orthodox wings of the Christian Church, excuse me. There was Patriarch Kirill met up with Francis. So now, obviously, you know, he's just he's taking it to the next level, taking it to second base, going to an island with the Orthodox Church. And
The whole band is kind of reunited,
yeah,
as it were.
Yeah.
It's a reunion tour. It's a reunion tour.
500 years
they
too late.
They hated each other, didn't they, for 20 years. They didn't speak. They only spoke. They got faxes from each other's agents, but now they were getting together on Lesbos.
I think the original justification for the split between the Roman and Byzantine arms of the church was artistic differences.
Yeah.
I think that set the precedent for the explanation of band breakups from length forward.
That's basically it. But, Pink Floyd eat your heart out.
Sure.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's happening. Will it make any difference whatsoever? I suspect not. But a lot of people care about what the Pope does and says, as I've said before, on this platform. And, it's nice that he's sticking to his principles and, you know, he sticks up for the little guys. I like that about him.
Yeah.
On the 11th of April, the Diplomat Magazine Award Gala is being held in London.
That's weird and good.
The Diplomat magazine, I initially thought it was for UK diplomats based abroad. No, it's for the diplomatic community in London.
Right.
So last year, the categories included... So you've got the regional ones of the Middle East, Africa, Asia, Eurasia, Europe, North America, and the Caribbean. That's in one category. And then you've got Central and South America. You also have Outstanding Contribution to the Press Corps and Young Diplomat of the Year. Which was won last year by Mr. Christian Sis, Vice Consul for the Embassy of Belgium.
How old is he?
I don't know.
Is this like sort of like under 13s category?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Like I think I was talking to you about how there are different considerations of what's young and old in different professions.
Mm.
You know, you're considered to be a young architect up to about 40.
Yeah.
You know,
50 even, I think.
50 even, yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, you're author, similar thing. But, you know, rock musician... Lower threshold, you know, let's be honest.
27.
27 Club, famously, yeah. Exactly. So I don't know what...
That sounds like a really interesting thing that we should genuinely cover have something on the radio about this.
Definitely. You know. I think it'll be really, really interesting.
Maybe get one of the winners in on next week.
We occasionally have a copy of the Diplomat magazine in the office. I've seen it.
Yeah, good.
That's one of those ones that gets snaffled up, doesn't it? Like the New Yorker, people just want to take that home, don't they? Read it in the bath.
Snorked up, yeah. Or, well, I mean, anywhere they like, you know.
Well, where else? What other room are you thinking?
No, living room, bedroom, observatory of a sunny afternoon. Why not?
I don't think Henry's had his feet since the beginning of this episode, but carry on.
Finally, I've not got much information about this, but I'll be intrigued to see where it takes your imagination. On the 10th of April, North Korea will hold the Pyongyang Marathon.
Okay.
Now.
Okay.
They keep on saying this, and then they say...
I've got an idea who might win. I bet you I know who will win.
His name's Kim.
No,
Kim.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe the fit man. Mm. Marcus Hippie's been doing more and more runs recently, longer and longer runs, so I thought we might be able to enter him into it and get him to do a package, maybe. I'm not sure if that's within the budget.
Or do a package on what it's like to be in prison for 4 years.
An underwear package, maybe.
Maybe. Do we need to... Are we going to bookend this with underwear?
Yes. What do you have on today?
Okay.
It's a grey gingham.
A grey gingham.
It's a grey gingham.
Yeah, okay.
Nice and roomy down there.
Yeah.
So nothing awry.
And I must say, I did get a peek of the grey gingham.
Did you?
Yeah, I can validate that.
What's been happening today? Who's been looking at whose pants?
Well, that's why I haven't looked at anyone's pants.
Okay.
Deliberately. Right. Am I generally drawn to that area?
Well, we've got something to talk to Edwina, which comes in about. Grey gingham, is that a thing? Is that a good move, a bad move? What does it say about the wearer?
I'd be interested, personally, in hearing. I'm not sure. I don't self-analyse in that
big department. Listen to the rest of the show.
I will be.
I know I will be. I'll be there.
And if Blanfords want to know where their old tablecloths have gone, I can tell you.
Stitched.
Fashioned one into an undergarment.
Henry, thanks. That was pants.
Thank you, guys.
We start today's show by looking skywards to the moon and to a handful of people who have made a visit there. Eugene Cernan is one of those people, an aviator, naval officer and NASA astronaut. He is one of only 12 individuals to have set foot on its surface. And since that day in 1972, nobody's been back since.
British documentary filmmaker Mark Craig wanted to know what life must be like back on Earth for those who've been to such great heights. His resulting film is The Last Man on the Moon. A new documentary looking at the life of Cernan and his fellow astronauts in the Apollo program. We'll be talking to Mark in just a second, but let's hear a clip first from the movie.
We had a mission to do, all working towards the same goal.
We were pretty impressed with ourselves. We had big egos.
But we knew going in that some people weren't going to make it.
What happened? They're dead.
If you think going to the moon is hard, you ought to try staying home.
And Mark Craig joins us now on the line. Welcome to the programme, Mark.
Hello there. Thank you for having me.
And first of all, was Mr. Cernan a kind of natural in front of the camera? I mean, he seemed that way. Obviously, there's a lot of publicity surrounding the Apollo missions. But did he enjoy getting back into the saddle, talking about this kind of time of his life and being on camera, being the centre of attention?
To be honest, I don't think he's ever left the saddle. I think when he was selected as an astronaut back in 1964, the media spotlight has never left him. Never more so than when he came back from the moon. But really, you know, in the decades that have passed since, it's pretty hard to escape having gone there. There's too many people around who never want to let you forget it.
And what made you engage with him now? He wrote this book about his life back in, 1999. You know, he has been around a long time. Space comes in and out of focus for us as a topic, as, you know, missions go or don't go. But why did you feel that this was the time to tell his story?
Well, I think a couple of reasons, really. I mean, I felt I needed to be ready to tell his story. I think enough time had to pass in my life and career before I appreciated what it all meant back then. I began to get interested in reading astronaut autobiographies again, and so I began doing that. And I read quite a few books, and his was one of them. But his was the one that absolutely leapt out at me as being a great story. And certainly the way he told it was a great story. And it wouldn't leave my head, you know, and I just thought, I've got to try and make this film happen. Obviously, a film of this scale, you know, it's always the director that gets, you know, a certain amount of attention, but really it would have been impossible had I not teamed up with Mark Stewart and all of his team. I mean, we've been on quite a journey together with Gene Cernan for many years. In fact, it's taken all manner of very hardworking and talented people, from special effects to archive to sound design to cinematography. So this really is a huge team effort, and hopefully we've all come together well to produce something that people will like.
And I guess interesting also that, you know, what I was really aware of during the film was that so many people who were involved in those missions are actually still around, still agile mentally, could still talk about it. I presume that won't be the case in 10 years' time.
Well, we've already lost nearly half the moonwalkers. I mean, there's 7 out of the 12 left alive now. They're all 80 plus. So, yeah, I mean, you know, who knows who'll still be around then. But I think certainly 44 years on from when he came back, he certainly has a different perspective on the whole picture than he did at the time. I think it's very valuable for younger people who weren't around at the time. And even people, you know, of my age who was a kid in the 60s, he is a sort of not just a national treasure, but a world treasure, really. And you know, I think it's important to hear what he has to say. And it's important maybe to ask him a few questions that he might not have been asked before.
And before we go back to Eugene Cernan himself, and I guess we could call it his journey. I suppose that's what you call it when you're pitching a film to producers, Mark. The idea of a man going through many changes during the course of the film. But I wanted to ask you about using all that amazing material. I mean, space is such a telegenic filmic thing, both in fiction and non. Was it great to be able to have all this sort of phenomenal material at your disposal of launches, of dockings, of men walking on the moon, all the rest of it? Is that fantastic stuff to play with?
Well, I guess you're referring to the archive, and yes, absolutely. I mean, NASA went out of their way to document everything that was going on through that entire time frame. I mean, there are just hundreds of thousands of images and you know, millions of feet of film that was shot. And, you know, we certainly had to dig deep to uncover it all. I was personally interested in as much of Gene Cernan's personal archive as I could get my hands on, in terms of photograph albums and scrapbooks and fragments of home movies that we found, you know. And I think that, you know, reinforces the personal tale that unfolds alongside the historical one.
I want to ask you about that personal tale, because I think one of the other interesting things is there's a slight reassessment of the role of the wives in this film. You know, we got used to seeing old pictures of them standing there with their beehives and their backcombed hair, looking like the perfect American housewives always. But they explain in this film that they were, you know, they were the bedrock. They were the people who kept these people going. They suffered as well. I think his former wife says, "You think it's tough going to space, you try not going to space, being the one that stays behind." And his relationships come under the spotlight too. Why did you think it was important to tell that story about the women and, you know, the failures of marriages, etc., that were wrapped around the space program?
Well, I think he just kept volunteering that information. I mean, it's a part of who he is and what goes around his head. I mean, you can ask Gene Cernan any question you like, and sooner or later he starts volunteering what the impact that it did have on his wives and the friends and the friends that he lost and all those things that go kicking around his head.
And just there, you also hint at something else, which is we think of the space race as being kind of, you know, successful, and we forget all the hiccups. In a way, he got to the top of the pile because people died. There were terrible tragedies, which you see in this film. Again, was that important? Because, you know, that brings the drama to the film in a way. We've kind of forgotten those terrible tragedies in some sense.
Well, for sure. I think the public at large often get caught up with the success of everything. And obviously, you know, men travelling to the moon and 6 times and doing all kinds of experiments and EVAs was a fantastic achievement. But those astronauts never forgot the sacrifices that were made along the way, and Gene Cernan goes out of his way to pay his dues to those people. And certainly, you know, the wives who suffered as well in their own ways. I mean, what can you say? You know, if you reach higher and further than you've ever done before in any endeavour, you're going to sort of pay some price along the way. And I think it's Gene Kranz who speaks very wisely on it, that risk is the price of progress, and no one knows the meaning of that more than those guys.
And on that, it's an interesting thing. I wonder if Eugene, looking back then, wonders if there's been a dearth of ambition, I suppose, on behalf of the various space agencies of the world for him to have been the last man on the moon, as the film says in its title.
Yeah, I think it takes a lot of things to come together at the same time before great things like that can happen. I mean, the space race obviously came out of some kind of turmoil between two superpowers. You know, it also was inspired by the maybe the right president at the right time, JFK, who just made that statement that ignited some action. It was also a post-war kind of era, so maybe people were less inclined with the risk factor and the you know the health and safety as we know it today. And times change. Cernan has told us, in, you know, who worked on the production, that it was almost like back then you reached forward way into the future and plucked a decade and brought it back, and that was the 60s. You know, it was almost superhuman what was achieved back then. From the time that Kennedy made that challenge to the time Neil Armstrong stepped out onto the lunar surface was like 9 years. You know, it was within the decade. Could you imagine somebody saying, right, we're going to the moon now and doing it in the decade? I don't know. I think it'd be tougher to achieve now than it was then in some weird way.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I wonder just finally, Mark, whether you feel in making this film, in speaking to Eugene and in looking at all this footage and putting such a lot of context around these events, whether you actually feel like you're looking at the past or the future. I mean, we know you're looking at the past, but I wonder whether you feel like it is something that will be a long time in happening again.
Well, who knows? I mean, you know, when you talk about the context of time, I mean, in our lifetimes and in decades, I mean, they're almost blinks, you know, when you compare it with the hugeness of time and space and the history that, you know, humans have been on this planet. I think when you look back at great historical events in Elizabethan times, I mean, does it really matter whether it was a decade or 50 years, you know, when you look back in the real big picture? So I think it must happen, because I think it's human desire to keep reaching out and pushing the boundaries and going out there. When it will happen, well, I just think it, you know, it goes in cycles, and I think you need the right things to align at the right time. And that is partly leadership, it's partly financial, political. And, you know, I think when collectively all those things line up, then I think anything is possible.
Perfect. Well, Mark, thank you very much. Congratulations on The Last Man on the Moon. The film is in UK cinemas now. Go to thelastmanonthemoon.com for more details, including a live satellite Q&A with Mark and Eugene this coming Monday. You're tuned into The Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Time for some new music now. We'll be talking Australia in a moment, so let's hear something Aussie. This is Gordy, aka 22-year-old Sophie Payton, based in Sydney, with Can We Work It Out? That was Australian songwriter Gordy with Can We Work It Out? You're tuned into The Monocle Weekly. Up next, Australia.
Meet the Writers is the show in which we have a chance to get intimate with some exciting authors. Airing at 1500 every Saturday and available as a podcast thereafter, it's an in-depth discussion about the life and work of a different writer every week, with me, Georgina Godwin, on Monocle 24.
Here at Monocle, the practice of koala diplomacy, the use of those cuddly Australian marsupials to spread the nation's culture abroad, is one of our favourite pet subjects. And the koala has been in the headlines again this week, thanks to a blue-hued bear named Borobi. He's the new mascot for Australia's upcoming Gold Coast 2018 Commonwealth Games.
But blue fluffy bears aside, we thought it'd be a good opportunity to get something of a masterclass in diplomacy involving koalas or not from Australian High Commissioner to UK, Alexander Downer, who is also the country's longest-serving foreign minister. Alexander, thank you so much for coming in to see us. The comedy of the bear aside, in a way, it's interesting how Australia does use its animals and its icons to brand itself around the world, whether that's, you know, the kangaroo on the tail fin of a Qantas jet. When you come to a country, I'm sure you're trying to broaden people's perceptions of what the nation's about. What's that balance between using, you know, the cliches and the warm things that we respond to, and also trying to surprise people about what Australia is about?
Well, it's a fair question. I suppose the first surprise for you is to say that a koala is, by the way, not a bear. And
yeah, right. So, we stand corrected already.
We were wondering about marsupials and things
marsupial,
as well.
Marsupial, yes. Yeah, but yeah. You always know you're not talking to an Australian when they describe a koala as a bear. Look, Australia has unique flora and fauna, and people use the word unique rather loosely, but it is unique. We have not just wonderful animals, but also magnificent birds, beautifully coloured birds, and a huge number of birds. One of the things you find when you leave Australia is the lack of birds in many of the places. You get quite a lot of birds in the UK, but it is a characteristic of Australia, its flora and fauna. But you quite rightly say, how do you get the balance right? There's a business here called Deliveroo. And, you know, it reminds you of a kangaroo the whole time because that's their symbol. So, you know, Australia gets a lot of free publicity because of its animals. On the other hand, how do we surprise? Mainly, I think it's in the arts that Australia continues to surprise wonderful singers. And I went to Les Miserables a couple of nights ago to see an Australian perform there in the role of Fantine. Australian opera singers on with the Royal Opera and the English National Opera, Australians at the Royal College of Music, and of course our pop stars are very famous. There's an Australian on the front page of one of the newspapers today who, to be honest with you, I hadn't heard of, but I was glad to see she was Australian, who is an actress who's in a new TV series coming up. The front page of a newspaper.
I thought you were going to say, and Australians can also dodge tax. Every endearing quality you could possibly want.
What I can say about Australians is that they, all Australians who pay tax, try to keep their tax to minimum. There's much discussion about this in relation to our own Prime Minister, who's a very rich man.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, people have been asking questions, but he wasn't mentioned in the Panama Papers, I hasten to say.
Okay, right. Nothing's missing down the back of the sofa.
Funnily enough, in fact, in the case of Australia and the Panama Papers, the Australians who were identified were sort of gangsters and criminals. There were no sort of well-known public figures.
Marsupial, I mean, if you're a marsupial, you've got a pouch. We always got somewhere to put it. No one's allowed in there.
Yes.
Well, but I guess what
I think
is,
the tax man is, by the way, allowed anywhere.
He's allowed anywhere.
He can go into any pouch.
You tickle any animal under the armpits. It's a free house on the pouch. I guess what Andrew is alluding to is that idea of goodwill that so many people have towards Australia there, Alexandra. And that's one of those things. I mean, the animals, I guess there's, and we're talking also about the 2018 Commonwealth Games, the announcement of which and your mascot, which is this blue koala. There's the idea of great competence in terms of sports, in terms of winning them and competing in them and being fairly charming at winning them, apart from at cricket, obviously. But there's that idea of goodwill. Does that make your job as High Commissioner easier, or does it make it sometimes tougher to talk about some of the tougher things you have to do?
No, it's look, honestly, here in the UK, it's very easy. People can identify very, very readily with Australians. Yeah. Obviously, culturally, they're very much kith and kin. And people like Australia. I mean, Australia is a... I'm biased, though, by the way. I'm the Australian High Commissioner, so you can take this with a pinch of salt. But I mean, I can talk about Australia's faults because it definitely has them, but basically a wonderful lifestyle. So, you know, there's no city in the world more interesting intellectually than London. That, I think, is irrefutable. On the other hand, the quality of life in Australian cities is a lot better than the quality of life in British or European cities. It's a fantastic quality of life. Well, hard to beat. I mean, the Economist Intelligence Unit says Melbourne is the world's most livable city. And of the top 10, I think 4 of the world's most livable cities are Australian cities. So that is a great strength of Australia. Yes, competitive in sport. We have that glorious expression, you don't win a silver, you lose a gold.
Yeah, right.
It says it all. I mean, obviously, we don't always win, and people here like to draw attention to the fact that even though we are the world's number one test cricket team, nevertheless, we lost the Ashes series here last year. And, you know, we didn't win the final in the World Cup rugby. We lost in the final. We came second in that, though we did get through the pool. Australians are very optimistic people, and they're optimistic about their country. There's this sort of subliminal message in Australia, which may or may not be true, but this is how people feel. Our best days lie ahead of us. that we're on a mission to somewhere even better than where we already are. You don't get that much in Europe. There's a bit of a sense in Europe that, you know, our glory days are behind us. The Industrial Revolution, the Empire, all the, they were our glory days. But in Australia, well, you know, we had all of those things, but we think we had a little empire of our own. We, you know, Papua New Guinea, Australian Antarctica. If you take it in square miles, Australian Antarctica is a huge area, by the way. On that basis, we have the biggest empire in the world today.
And tell me, you know, you're sitting here in the UK. One of the most extraordinary things about the UK is the number of Aussies here. We certainly have a team worth of Australians working for Monocle across various floors. But the diaspora seems to me a very powerful tool as well. And you know, whether that's in the food industry, whether it's in setting up independent coffee stores, you're likely to meet an Australian from the minute you kind of leave your house in service industries, in healthcare, in doctors, all sorts of things. Is that diaspora something that you can tap into? How do you kind of manage to pull that together when there are so many people here?
It's a problem as well as an advantage. I mean, it is a huge advantage. For example, we're putting together a function for Australians working in the civil service here in London, and you know, everywhere from the Treasury, the Foreign Office even has Australians. I mean, they're actually quite senior people in the Foreign Office who are Australian citizens, and the Ministry of Defence and so on. They're all kinds of people, and in business, yes, there are Australians everywhere. Australians like to come here, not necessarily to migrate, but they like to come for a while. It used to be very much a rite of passage for young Australians to come to the great imperial capital and get to know the excitement of London. And still today, huge numbers come. I mean, there are 24 million Australians, a million Australians a year visit the UK.
Do they all get on with each other? Is there a... Do you know what I mean?
They get on better with each other when they're here than when they're in Australia.
When there's a focal point. Yeah. Well, that's the thing.
There'll be no surprise there. So they may have, for example, different politics, but yeah, they can set that aside when they're out of the country. When they get back, hostilities resume.
Do you have to manage that? Is there any part of your job in which you have to take a kind of, take a pulse of as Andrew was saying, the Australian diaspora, at least here in the UK?
Mainly not, no. They get on with their own lives here because they can fit in so easily.
Yeah.
So they don't really have cultural problems here, and obviously they don't have language problems.
But I wonder whether you're interested in new kind of things that the Aussies are doing here in the UK.
Well, there is an issue here, and that is there are about 72,000 Australians on the electoral roll, which is a lot. And Australians are able to go onto the electoral roll here after they've been here for just 6 months. So these 72,000 Australians will be able to vote on the 23rd of June on whether Britain leaves the EU or not. So we've been trying to find out what they think. We'd be very interested.
Yeah.
The Australian government's position is to support Britain remaining in the EU. We think that's in Europe's best interests and, you know, and more importantly, in our best interests. But what do these 72,000 Australians who might vote think? So we sent out tweets to them. I hope some of them are listening to this program because we sent out tweets and put things on Facebook and they never reply. So, you know, my fear is they don't care.
Okay. Well, the proof of the pudding will be in the X marks the spot, I suppose.
I suppose. Yeah.
Can I also ask you, you've been here for a few years now. You were also one of the longest serving foreign ministers in Australia. But meanwhile, Australian politics has become the most topsy-turvy kind of seat-changing operation you've ever seen. I think just in the past, you know, 3 years, you've probably seen four prime ministers. Is that a terrible thing for you to try and respond to? Because you're trying to offer some consistency to explain the government line, and it has changed rather a lot.
It changes. Even the personalities have changed. Now, what you say is true. On the other hand, there is quite a consistency of policy in Australia. So it's not as though Australian foreign policy, when the Prime Minister changes, dramatically changes. In fact, the last change of Prime Minister, foreign policy has barely changed at all. And economic policy, well, you know, the new Prime Minister's introduced their different initiatives, but Australia's basically a liberal market economy, and there's sort of pretty much consensus across the political system in support of open trade and open borders. So immigration has been a big issue in Australia, but there's broad support both amongst the political class and the public for taking migrants. We take about 200,000 migrants a year for resettling refugees, but we don't take people who try to come to Australia by courtesy of people smugglers, paying people smugglers to come to Australia, so we kick them out. So there's pretty much consensus about those things. So changing prime ministers, it is disruptive. There's no doubt about that. It's almost embarrassing.
We should just tap you on that because, you know, I know that's an issue that has been contentious, and it's interesting to hear you be quite robust on the issue of people smuggling and how migrants...
Well, good luck to you Europeans dealing with it now.
Exactly.
You can see what we dealt with.
Yeah, so I think that's a question that David Cameron here in the UK has said he would rather deal with people who are in camps in Turkey, in camps on the border of Syria, rather than deal with people who have got to Europe. And that's the way that he will press ahead. Hmm. It hasn't certainly stopped the migration into Europe. Hundreds of thousands of people are still to come. But again, interesting to hear what you say. Do you feel that Australia has had a real battering on this issue? Because many people around the world have commented, that it has been seen a little brutal. We saw the case recently of a baby that had been burnt in an internment camp, and there was a campaign by doctors and nurses to refuse that child being sent back. Mm-hmm. And that became headlines around the world again. Mm. Just give us your take on that.
Well, I'm not going to comment on the truth of that story. I mean, there was a baby that was burnt in Nauru, and it was sent to Australia for medical treatment. Well, that was the appropriate thing to do. But how it was burnt and why it was burnt is information that we know. And suffice it to say that people in Australia aren't crueler than people anywhere else on earth. Maybe that would be the best way of putting it to you. Of course, they're not. They're perfectly kind. I'm not saying they're kinder, but they're perfectly kind people and wouldn't want any harm to come to a baby. And no Australian had anything to do with the harm that came to that baby. Not that Australians haven't caused harm to people. We have our murderers. But I think Europe is now waking... Yes, there's been a lot of criticism by Europeans without really understanding what the issues were. And now Europe can see what the issues were. Now, we actually have a much better organised immigration policy than Europe. We have an active immigration policy. We say we do want migrants to come to our country. Europe doesn't have an immigration policy. And we take about 200,000 a year, and we only have 24 million people, so it's an awful lot of migrants. Also, in that quota, we resettle refugees. That's something Europe doesn't do. We have a refugee resettlement program, so we go actively to the UN, and we say every year we're just increasing our quota to 18,000. We'll take 18,000 refugees every year. But if you want to, and this is a qualification, if you want to come to Australia, they're the ways you can come. If you want to pay a people smuggler to make a perilous journey on a boat, risking your life, we'll find you, because, we're a technologically sophisticated country, and we'll send you back. Not send you back, not refoul you, not send you back to the country you came from, but we'll send you back to Indonesia. Or we might move you to Nauru for processing, but you won't come to Australia. I know it's a tough policy. But we've done that on the grounds that if we allow our immigration policy to fall beyond our control, many things will flow from that. And one of them is that the public won't accept it. And that will undermine, and quite brutally undermine, public support for immigration. And we know to be a successful country, we have to have migrants. All of the successful countries in the world attract migrants, and we see it as a competition to go out into the world and find the smartest and the best people. We don't care whether they're Muslims or atheists or Jews or Christians or whatever they are, and we don't care what colour they are, but we want good, smart people to come to our country and help to develop our country. But to have a random policy where anyone can come, we can't control our borders... I tell you what, the public won't cop it, and you'll create social dislocation within the country. It's just a really bad idea. So we just put up with the criticism. Sure, people have been critical of us, but I think Europe now understands better than they ever did why we did what we did, and it worked.
And just to take it back, so we talked about koala diplomacy. We're talking about these games in 2018, the Commonwealth Games. People presumably can see by the array of different sorts of athletes of all sorts of different colours and persuasions that represent Australia in those games, every other country, that this policy could well work. And
well, some people have criticised us for saying that we'll give anybody who's an elite athlete a visa wherever they're from and however little English they speak. There was a case of in 2000 when we hosted the Olympic Games, there was a case of a Russian pole vaulter And just sorry, I can't remember her name. Grigoryeva, I think her name was, but don't hold me to that. I don't think she spoke a word of English, honestly. But we gave her a visa and made her an Australian as fast as we could, and she won a gold medal. So. there you are. There Talk you about are. A country that's hungry to win.
I think we've wrapped up migrants and winning all in one beautiful, exactly. Charming Australian swoop. Alexander Deller, thank you very much.
It's a great pleasure.
Underwear. We all wear it. However, it's not something we all talk about so very often, but we'd never let a fusty social norm such as that hold us back on the Monocle Weekly, and neither will the Victoria and Albert Museum here in London.
This Saturday, the V&A will open the doors to their new exhibition, Undressed, A Brief History of Underwear. And we're very lucky to now be joined by the event's curator, Edwina Ehrman, who's a clothing historian and curator of textiles and fashion for the V&A. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you.
Tell us about this exhibition. Where have you found all of these undergarments from? Do they sit in drawers, as it were, at the V&A?
A lot of them sit in drawers at the V&A, but an exhibition for great opportunity for getting out material from our archives. We've got out quite a few things that have never been seen before by the public in exhibitions, but they're also a fantastic opportunity to acquire new pieces, because the exhibition starts around 1750, but it goes right up to the present day. So we've had some very generous donations from companies which have enabled us to expand our holdings.
You're looking at what men and women have worn underneath their clothing.
We're trying to look at them, but it isn't quite even, because men aren't very good at keeping their underclothes.
And women have more interesting things.
There's a moral now.
I think men tend to chuck things away. I think women are more sentimental, perhaps, about keeping things which are special for them. So it's about a fifth men and four-fifths women.
It's hard to be sentimental about your wife fronts.
But. Yeah, indeed. And you're a fashion historian, and you've done some of the wonderful couture shows at the V&A. Mm-hmm. Does underwear feel like the poor relation? Does it feel like it needs a bit of glamorous or intellectual light cast upon it? What?
I think underwear is far more interesting, much, much more interesting than I realised when this project was proposed to me. And I think gradually over the past 18 months, I've realised how incredibly important underwear have been throughout history and is to us today. There is a lot still to discover, and that's been one of the really interesting aspects of the exhibition. And the underwear industry is huge today, not just for women, for men as well. It's global. And I think that adds a whole new dimension to looking at it, at the industry at this particular point in time.
A couple of years ago, we had a guest on the show who had written a really wonderful book about Syrian underwear, and was hinting that, you know, even in the Middle East, when you see people very traditionally conservatively dressed, underneath there may be another story. Has that always been the case in underwear? Because I imagine when you start describing in the notes for this exhibition, some of the very early pieces, when women started wearing coloured petticoats, and there was a world of sex and allure even then underneath the skirts.
Well, absolutely. But I mean, it is certainly if you're going back to the 18th century, you had to be fairly well off to enjoy the best quality underwear. I mean, that's true throughout. But certainly in the Victorian period, when the ready-made market gets going, it's quite surprising what colours people enjoyed. Our ancestors weren't nearly as kind of coy, if we like to think they were. And there was plenty of lifting up of petticoats and showing coloured stockings. And people enjoyed, I think, their underclothes. And indeed, coloured corsets were certainly worn from at least the mid-19th century onwards. The area where people started getting worried was in the 1880s, when women started wearing coloured underwear against their skin. And for many conservative commentators, this was a step too far. That, you know, if you were a nice woman, you should be wearing pure white against your skin. Coloured corset were fine, but not pink, lavender, pale blue underwear.
And in many ways, people will try and put two and two together and make five with this exhibition. It's also sponsored, I think, it's partnered with Agent Provocateur, so people will be expecting to see some sexy stuff in here as well.
Oh, but you have to have that.
Of course. but I wonder how easy it is to be sexy, how easy it is to be surprisingly sexy. Not shocking, but surprisingly sexy, when people are quite used to it. Ever since Marky Mark wearing his Calvin Klein's, you know, and a lot of Victoria's Secret and Agent Provocateur commercials that we're probably very familiar with, and the imagery we're we're familiar with. Can you upset any apple carts, still, I wonder, with underwear?
Well, I think one of the problems about doing any fashion show, but particularly an underwear show, is that we are stuck with rigid mannequins. I mean, we can do a few things with their arms and all the rest of it.
So I've just found a smutty joke in there.
Yes.
Forgive me, Edwina.
Anyway, so it is a challenge. And so we have to work out ways in which to try and convey the more femme-fuel, alluring, erotic aspects of underwear. And we do have a case which, after a great deal of kind of struggle, I decided to call Temptation. I wanted to have a case where I could, in an area which is broadly speaking about underwear of outerwear, because we do cover that as well, I wanted to remind people we're still talking about underwear. And so we have included things like latex fetish set from House of Harlot. We've got, I think, a wonderfully sexy bra and brief set from Cadol in Paris, an outfit which is absolutely purely about role play. And so it's partly the way you caption things, and I know that people don't always read the object labels, and it's very much about juxtapositioning things and putting things at striking angle so that it makes people look at things again for a second time.
How much is our undergarments a reflection of the times? Can you chart a social history? Because when I look down some of the inventions that you have given us details for, so in the 1930s, you know, wife fronts are invented for men, pantyhose come in 1959, in the 60s, the Wonder Bra is created. So some of these things hint at kind of sexual liberation, some things hint at a kind of a new efficiency, a desire to, you know, be ready to go to work in 10 minutes. Do you look at these undergarments and realise they are charting bigger social changes?
Yes, and I think that's one thing that you can see in the exhibition, because one of our themes is looking at the impact of innovation in design and technology on underwear, but also that reflects the times that we live in. Indeed, all our clothes reflect the times that we live in. And I think particularly when you're looking, we have one case that looks at bras, girdles and pants from the 1930s through to the present day. And then I think, you know, you get things like the transparent bra in the 1960s, which, you know, would have been very shocking to some people. And we've juxtaposed that with an article from Nova about women who weren't wearing any bras at all. And it's a very interesting article with lots of photographs and comments. And so we're trying the whole time to get people to engage with that particular period. And by having a chronological display, I think you can get some kind of rhythm into it.
And how do you deal with that feminist moment, that burn the bra
moment? They didn't do that. They never did it. There was a journalist who compared a protest at the Miss America pageant to burning the call up for the draft papers, whatever they're called. And then she said afterwards she bitterly regretted this because, you know, it became this seminal moment and it was a myth. But we do obviously look at choice. And I think feminism embrace of choice. And by including things like the Nova article and by pointing out that many, many of the women involved in the underwear industry from the 19th century onwards, they were great inventors. They were registering designs, they were registering patents, they were active women involved in business. And we've included a lot of exercise. I want to get over this whole idea of women sitting at home fainting in the Victorian period. And it's a bit overt, I suppose, and it's a bit of a personal crusade.
But I guess we've got the sexy out of what was the painful, the whalebone corset has begot the agent provocateur sexy corset, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And also, you could argue, you could say, okay, so we all go on in our kind of 21st century way of saying, how could they wear a corset? And then you look at some of the things that people are proposing that women should wear today. I mean, a lot of the shapewear is suffocatingly tight and restricts movement. And waist trainers, not a great idea, and particularly when worn to the gym. You know, and so we're doing we are modifying our bodies in very similar ways.
And tell me, when you came to look at the men, men on the whole haven't kept their underwear, but there has been it's more complex in the male market, I think, anyway. You can't really do too many things because you look a bit foolish when your trousers come down. But there is a sense in that kind of David Beckham world of underwear, of the Calvin Klein invention, of, you know, having your pair of Calvins said something about you at that moment as well. There is a kind of sexiness for men that exists as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And we talk about premium men's underwear today. And, you know, and I think that brands like Calvin Klein and Tommy Hilfiger and particularly that David Beckham campaign for H&M and then, you know, David Gandy, I think what they're doing is they're encouraging men to think it's perfectly okay to think about dressing from the skin out, to think about, you know, your identity starts when you put that layer of underwear on, and also to, you know, perhaps be seen to take more of an interest in comfort and style and fashionability. And I think it is about fashionability. But we mock the Y front now, but it was, in its time, it was an absolutely major breakthrough. You know, your dad was wearing these horrible long, well, maybe not horrible, you know, long woolly long johns or union suit. And I think for young men too, it was radically different. It was neat trim, it provided discreet support, etc. And I think it must have been as much of a breakthrough for that generation as maybe the Calvins were for the 80th generation.
And we talked about wearing your underwear on the outside and how that's become something that you see at film premieres and certainly like in advertising campaigns for underwear. Is that very much like an end of the 20th century thing, or are there historical precedents for that?
There are historical precedents. You can take it right back to 16th century.
Those codpieces and all these kind of things, right?
Yes, codpieces were a very overt piece of male flamboyance. And then you have things like the slashed doublet jacket, where you would pull the linen over your shirt through the slit. And that, you know, showed the quality of your underwear and obviously your social standing and things like that. And you get Marie Antoinette wearing her chemise dress and, you know, kind of French high society being scandalised by it. So there are lots of examples all the way through history. But I think it really started as a fashion phenomenon in the 20th century, in the 1970s, when fashion-forward women, and particularly kind of models, were spotted in nightclubs wearing night dresses of evening dresses. And you get magazines again like Nova saying, if you show your bra strap, don't worry about it. Just make it look like you meant to show it. If you want to wear a vest and, you know, have your shirt unbuttoned, fine. And so I think it's beginning then, but I mean, we always tend to date it back to the 90s, you know, the flip dresses, et cetera. And Westwood, it was really important in the 80s.
I guess underwear, we're talking about the kind of, you know, the hint of sex, the kind of, you know, fetish, all sorts of things. But there's also a kind of thing which the disappearance of the vest, for example. Now, is that because, you know, just our houses got warmer and we're better insulated, that, you know, that actually underwear changed? It could be skimpier. It wasn't just the times that were changing. Actually, it's also a reflection of how our houses were engineered and our offices engineered.
No, absolutely. I mean, that's absolutely true. That, you know, you go from warm public transport briefly out into the cold and into a probably overheated office. And so we have shed the layers of our underwear. But on the other hand, you know, for a football match or spectator sport or whatever, then you do, you know, we probably all go off and get by it, wear our thermal vest.
Were there any pieces that came to light when you were doing the research that you thought, oh God, I'm so pleased I found this, or this is such a surprise?
I have a very plain item of clothing, which has been just such an eye-opener to me and quite embarrassing too. I've been working in this field for really quite a long time, and I came across this extraordinarily light and springy corset in our archive. And I know a collector in Holland, and I sent him a photograph and said, what do you make of this? And he wrote back and said, it is a woven corset. And then I discovered, through looking at catalogues for Victorian corsets, that there are pages and pages and pages of these things. And what they were, there are two types of corset. There's the one we all know about, which has seams and is made of pattern pieces. And then there is this corset where it's woven to shape, to the shape of a corset, with the pocket for the bones. And it's incredibly light and springy. It was washable. It weighs about a sixth of what one of these kind of very rigid corsets wave. And as I said, there are advertisements from everywhere. And I don't know how I possibly ignored them for so long. but they are briefly mentioned in underwear books. But it's been that was an absolute eye-opener. And the other thing that's been an eye-opener to everybody have been a discovery in Austria, at Lengberg Castle. They were doing some renovation work, and they found a kind of tip between two floors, which... And this tip of rubbish and textiles dates to between 1390 and 1465. And they have found some bras. I mean, there's no doubt about them. Everybody said the bra was invented, the first patent for the late 19th century, 1860 onwards. But these, you know, they have cups, they have shoulder straps, they have a long line bra with midriff. Extraordinary. And so this whole, what we've been telling everybody for donkey years, has just been thrown up in the air. And that's wonderful. That makes it exciting.
Well, Irina Ehrman, thank you very much for letting us look through the V&A's knicker drawer and also revealing the fact that it only takes, once Andrew's got his wife fronts on, he's 10 minutes and ready to go. Two unique looks into the world of media and museums there. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that is it, Andrew, for edition 353 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
We've been to the moon.
We've almost...
almost mooned.
I was going to say, if it weren't for our pants, we would have shown one. That was a really interesting programme, wasn't it? I really liked it.
I've had a lovely time today, thank you.
Yeah, it's been good, isn't it?
Yeah.
Sometimes it's one of those things where you feel like you're starting slowly and then you love it and then you get great guests on and it enlivens your entire day. Nice fun. Well, we want to wish all our listeners a very happy Sunday. We want to thank our friends behind the glass. Those are the producer Tom Hall, with help from Rhys James, and research by Charlie Young and Ilse Viveros. Our studio manager was Claire Urban. The Monocle Weekly will, of course, be back same time, same place next week. But for the time being, from me, Robert Bounds,
and me, Andrew Tuck,
thanks for tuning in.